For the Internet browser category, for example, looking at the product side of the equation, the generic product would be the set of functions first made popular by Mosaic, then by Netscape Navigator. The expected product would include portability to each of the popular client platforms, including Unix and Macintosh. The augmented product would include plugins from third parties to provide additional features. And the potential product would be the redefinition of the client, potentially to the exclusion of ever seeing the operating system. It was this last issue that galvanized Microsoft's response. On the services side, there has to be, at minimum, the generic product includes an internet service provider. The expected product includes a home page with a default search engine. The augmented product includes a variety of prearranged experiences presented as buttons or the like. And the potential product includes the reconstruction of consumer purchasing. Now, at the introduction of any new type of product, the marketing battle takes place at the level of the generic product, the thing in the center, the product itself. This is the hero in the battle for the early market. But as marketplaces develop, as we enter the mainstream market, products in the center become more and more alike, and the battle shifts increasingly to the outer circles. To understand how to dominate a mainstream marketplace, we need to take a closer look at the significance of what Paul Harvey might call the rest of the whole product. The whole product and the technology adoption lifecycle. First, let's look at how the whole product concept relates to crossing the chasm. If we look at the technology adoption lifecycle as a whole, we can generalize that the outer circles of the whole product increase in importance as one moves from left to right. That is, the customers least in need of whole product support are the technology enthusiasts. They are perfectly used to cobbling together bits and pieces of systems and figuring out their own way to a whole product that pleases them. In fact, this is in large part the pleasure they take from technology products. Puzzling through ways to integrate an interesting new capability into something they could actually use. Their motto is, real techies don't need whole products. For the visionaries, there is no pleasure in pulling together a whole product on their own. But there is an acceptance that if they are going to be the first in their industry to implement the new system, and thereby gain a strategic advantage over their competitors, then they are going to have to take responsibility for creating the whole product under their own steam. The rise in interest in systems integration is a direct response to increasing visionary interest in information systems as a source of strategic advantage. Systems integrators could just as easily be called whole product providers. That is their commitment to the customer. So much for the market to the left of the chasm, the early market. To get to the right of the chasm, to cross into the mainstream market, you have to first meet the demands of the pragmatist customers. These customers want the whole product to be readily available from the outset. They like a product such as Microsoft because there are not only books in every bookstore about how to use it, but also seminars for training, office hotline support, and a whole cadre of temporary office workers already trained on the product. If instead the pragmatists are offered a great deal on an alternative product, an office suite from Corel or Lotus, for example, they are not motivated to switch, because the rest of the whole product simply cannot match up. The same logic holds for why pragmatists prefer Intel's microprocessors to Digital's Alpha, Windows NT to Linux, Oracle to Sybase, SAP to QAD, Lotus Notes to Novell's GroupWise, Hewlett-Packard printers to Lexmark, and Sun workstations to Silicon Graphics. In every case, there are strong arguments that they are preferring an inferior product, if you look only at the generic product. But in every case, they are preferring the superior product, if you look at the whole product. To net this out, pragmatists evaluate and buy whole products. The generic product, the product you ship, is a key part of the whole product, make no mistake. But once there are more than one or two comparable products in the marketplace, then investing in additional R&D at the generic level has a decreasing return, whereas there is an increasing return for marketing investments at the levels of the expected, the augmented, or the potential product. How to determine where to target these investments is the role of whole product planning. Whole product planning. As we have just seen, the whole product model provides a key insight into the chasm phenomenon. The single most important difference between early markets and mainstream markets is that the former are willing to take responsibility for piecing together the whole product in return for getting a jump on their competition, whereas the latter are not. Failure to recognize this principle has been the downfall of many a high-tech enterprise. Too often, companies throw their products into the market as if they were tossing bales of hay off the back of a truck. There is no planning for the whole product, just the hope that their product will be so wonderful that customers will rise up in legions to demand that third parties rally about it. Well, God did divide the Red Sea for Moses. For those who wish to take a more prudent course, however, whole product planning is the centerpiece for developing a market domination strategy. Pragmatists will hold off committing their support until they see a strong candidate for leadership emerge. Then they will back that candidate forcefully in an effort to squeeze out the other alternatives, thereby bringing about the necessary standardization to ensure good whole product development in their marketplace. A good generic product is a great asset in this battle, but it is neither a necessary nor a sufficient cause of victory. Oracle did not have the best product when the market standardized on it. What Oracle offered instead was the best case for a viable whole product: SQL standardization plus broad portability across hardware platforms plus an aggressive sales force to drive product into the market quickly. That is what the pragmatists in MIS got behind. In short, winning the whole product battle means winning the war. And, because perception contributes to that reality, looking like you are winning the whole product battle is a key weapon to winning the war. On the other hand, pretending you are winning the whole product battle is a losing tactic. People check up on each other too much in a high-tech marketplace. These distinctions will become critically important in our next chapter, where we deal with positioning. For now, our focus should be on the minimum commitment to whole product needed to cross the chasm. That is defined by that whole product which assures that the target customers can fulfill their compelling reason to buy. To work out how much whole product this is, you need only a simplified version of the whole model. The illustration, the simplified whole product model, you can see in the enhanced portion of this audiobook. In the simplified model, there are only two categories. One, what we ship, and two, whatever else the customers need in order to achieve their compelling reason to buy. The latter is the marketing promise made to win the sale. The contract does not require the company to deliver on this promise, but the customer relationship does. Failure to meet this promise in a business-to-business market has extremely serious consequences. as the bulk of purchases in this marketplace are highly reference-oriented. Such failure can only create negative word of mouth, causing sales productivity to drop dramatically. Classically, high-tech has delivered 80 to 90% of a whole product to any number of possible target customers, but 100% to few, if any. Anything less than 100%, unfortunately, means that the customers either supply the remainder themselves or feel cheated. Significantly less than 100% means that the target market simply does not develop as forecast. Even if the generic product, the product in the box being shipped, is superior to anything else in its class. In short, if you wanted to trace disillusionment with high tech's inability to deliver on its promise to its investors and its customers, lack of attention to whole product marketing is the closest thing to a wellspring. This is actually good news. It means that the converse applies as well. By solving the whole product equation for any given set of target customers, high tech has overcome its single greatest obstacle to market development. Let's look at an example to see how this works. The electronic book, revisited. Let's revisit the after scenario for the electronic book. Here it is again. New approach. Ernie pulls out his ebook, which contains all documentation for the Boeing 737 E-Series, searches for Srivastat, finds the section, including the diagram and the latest revisions, all automatically downloaded each night. There's a hyperlink in the text to a knowledge base where actual experiences are tracked. Clicking on it, Ernie spots the problem in a flash, applies the fix, and the plane is on its way. Okay, actually the plane is still delayed, and I am still on it, but that's another story. Now, let's analyze this scenario in light of its implied whole product commitments. There are several. Pulls out his ebook. Okay, this is a minor one, but from where? It weighs 3 pounds, remember? And it is breakable. How does Ernie carry this thing around? At minimum, we probably need a case with a strap, and we may want a handle on the book itself. In addition, we probably want an industrial-strength chassis, but without adding weight, which contains all the documentation for the Boeing 737E. Oh, really? And where did all that documentation come from? Ideally, it would be all in one electronic. But in fact, there are numerous subcontractors submitting changes all the time in file formats different from one another and from the original itself. Solving this problem is something that specialized document management software like Documentum's addresses. Moreover, it is a major project to populate the database at the outset, and it takes considerable resources going forward to maintain it. All automatically downloaded each night. This implies a docking station for the ebook, or an interface to a PC that serves as such. It implies a raft of IT department procedures to ensure ongoing quality and consistency. It implies sufficient network bandwidth to get the download done in a timely manner. And it implies a connectivity port that can handle high volume, perhaps not the USB port that comes with a standard ebook, but a 1394 FireWire port instead. There is a hyperlink in the text. Only if someone or something put it there. This, in turn, implies an indexing effort, either manual or through some form of artificial intelligence engine, to a knowledge base where actual experiences are tracked. This implies a customer support system such as those supplied by Clarify, Vantiv, Cybel, and others. It also implies a programmed interface between that system and the ebook. clicking on it. Well, if the clicking is going to do anything, we just added some sort of wireless modem to the ebook, a lot of software to navigate the connectivity, and an interface to walk Ernie through the process. And so on. The point is, even a single target customer profile starts off a chain of issues that any product manager serious about developing a particular market opportunity must pursue to a satisfactory conclusion. Now, in the case of an electronic book, you might imagine a fairly lengthy list of potential target customers and target applications. In addition to maintenance repair people like Ernie, one could imagine doctors doing diagnoses or writing drug prescriptions, in which case it should be a lot smaller, support Boolean search arguments, and be able to display special symbols. Lawyers, doctors, real estate agents, and others seeking to pass a certification exam, in which case it should support simple quizzing. College students with heavy reading loads, in which case it should be supported by all the major publishers, be downloadable over a 56KB modem, and incorporate an intellectual property management system that allows for excerpts and partial royalties. General readers in remote locations, such as surveyors or field scientists, in which case, in addition to the connectivity, it should support an e-commerce system for browsing and buying books. Outdoor readers, in which case it should have special lighting or screen characteristics to compensate for glare. As even this cursory listing indicates, every additional new target customer will put additional new demands on the whole product. That is, the total sum of products and services needed in order to get the desired benefit changes anytime you change the value proposition. It soon becomes clear to even the most optimistic product marketing managers that they cannot go after all markets at once, that at minimum, they have to sequence and prioritize opportunities, and that each opportunity has very real support costs. Now, given the need for a whole product in order to fulfill the customer's reason to buy, what is the responsibility of the tablet computer hardware vendor, and specifically of the product marketing manager who has the tablet PC as his product, for seeing that this whole product is in fact delivered? The answer is, it has nothing to do with responsibility. It has to do with marketing success. If you leave your customer's success to chance, you are giving up control over your own success. Conversely, by thinking through your customer's problems and solutions in their entirety, you can define and work to ensure that the customer gets the whole product. At no time is this marketing proposition more true than when crossing the chasm. Prior to the chasm, there is some hope that the visionaries will backfill the whole product through their own systems integration efforts. Once the product is established in the mainstream, there is some hope that some third party will see an opportunity for itself to make money fleshing out the whole product. But while you are crossing the chasm, there is no hope of any external support that is not specifically recruited by you for this purpose. Some real-world examples. To see how this works out in actual practice, let's turn now to some specific industry examples. Basically, there are two types of scenarios we want to work through. One, where there is installed competition, and the other, where there is not. In the former case, it is as if one is trying to invade Normandy from England, and the installed market leader is playing the role of the Nazi forces. In the latter, it is as if one had landed on a new continent and decided to set up shop selling wares to the natives. Neither task is for the faint of heart. Lawson Software and Client-Server Business Applications. To begin with the competitive example, Imagine yourself back in 1993 as a $40 million business application software company located in Minneapolis, Minnesota, early to make the move to client-server architecture, and therefore currently included in the list of market leaders. The market has not crossed the chasm. Instead, the media is picking up on the first burst of enthusiasm for client-server applications. Your companions on the media hot list are PeopleSoft and Oracle, both already out in front of you. Oracle, in particular, is more than an order of magnitude bigger than you, and PeopleSoft is the media darling. You have never even heard or know about SAP, the eventual dominant leader in this market, which is probably just as well, as then you really would have been sick to your stomach. The point is, if this were a car race, they have Grand Prix racing staffs, and you and your brother are entered in your streetcar. Now what? Oddly enough, Lawson decided that it had the advantage. This is a form of optimism that can only be built in the Midwest. It has something to do with the winters. It knew that to be interesting and viable as a company going forward, it had to become a market leader in something. Its advantage was that it knew it couldn't be the overall market leader, and that it had to focus immediately, if only to survive. Commitment to focus is the critical success factor for crossing the chasm, something very hard to gain in larger institutions, which are always looking for big market returns right out of the box. Lawson was pretty sure that it could get a multi-year head start in a niche market by focusing right at the start, and that's precisely what it did. There were several areas where the company had market momentum that could be developed into niche leadership, the two most prominent of which were healthcare and retail. It chose to focus on healthcare for two reasons. First, with the advent of capitated health insurance that came early in the 1990s, the finance function in healthcare was thrown into turmoil, with all of its existing computer systems needing dramatic overhaul in order to provide critical information on costs. Second, the healthcare segment was consolidating into a relatively small number of major customers. This made it more attractive, because it meant that a smaller company could dominate the segment sooner. When segments are too large or diffuse, early leaders can be displaced by fast-following competitors who have greater resources to apply to the opportunity. As the campaign got underway, even this focus needed to be sharpened, and the target narrowed to a beachhead segment called Integrated Delivery Networks, or IDNs, entities formed by the merger of clinics, hospitals, and physician practice groups. This was an emerging segment, so it was not on the radar screens of the traditional marketing teams. Hence, it was easier for Lawson to steal a march on its larger competitors. Within it, the target customer was the CFO and staff, and the compelling reason to buy was the desperate need to get pricing control over a new business model, to be able to understand revenue and costs by patient, by procedure, by fixed asset, by healthcare plan, and the like, because that was how the rest of the world proposed to pay them going forward. Now the definition of the whole product is the minimum set of products and services needed to fulfill the compelling reason to buy for the target customer. In that light, Lawson built the following offer. Core application software, running on top of Unix hardware to fulfill the standard needs of any financial organization, including a general ledger, accounts receivable, accounts payable, fixed assets, and the like. This was the price of entry. Note, at the time, customers had no interest in support for NT, nor for the Internet. These were added subsequently, the latter with particularly dramatic impact. An integrated, activity-based costing module designed for maximum flexibility that allowed the organization to analyze and then capture costs and revenues by patient, by procedure, or by any other variable in the business mix. This was a godsend because it operated outboard of the core financial system, and thus users could execute what-if scenarios with great freedom. Materials management software to minimize waste and increase return on both high-volume inventories of low-cost items, intravenous fluids, needles, and low-volume inventories of very high-cost items, artificial hips, intraocular lenses, and the like. This required some healthcare-specific development, including supporting a unit of inventory management called the PAR cart, something akin to a delivery truck that travels the halls of the hospital replenishing its various rooms. No other client-server financials vendor supported PAR carts at the time, so Lawson was able to use this one feature as a signal of its special level of commitment to the segment. Internet integration, which allowed IDNs to rapidly deploy new business processes on a common and consistent basis. This digital nervous system became a critical prerequisite for capturing returns from the economies of scale that IDNs deliberately seek to achieve. Workflow software. To ensure that as IDNs re-engineered their business processes to improve their cost effectiveness, the new procedures could be woven into the financial and materials management systems without major disruption. This came along with training, not just in the software, but in workflow analysis and the construction of new procedures. Interfaces to legacy application systems, particularly those in patient management. The two market-leading vendors in this area are SMS and HBOC, neither of which chose to make Lawson their strategic partner. Too small. So Lawson had to go the extra mile to make sure these interfaces worked effectively. Later on, the company's market leadership approach would have its reward, with SMS terminating a relationship it had with PeopleSoft and installing Lawson as its strategic partner, based on the company's success in penetrating the IDN market. Finally, healthcare finance organizations simply needed support, somewhat in the sense of therapy. Every vendor offered the standard training and installation package, but Lawson went the extra mile and lined up consultants who could advise and train on active-based cost accounting, help set up and tune the system to get the kind of answers the CEO was demanding, and in some cases, help go get the answers ahead of the system in a crisis. Those relationships were the most valued of all, and Lawson's role as a trusted advisor, helping to bring the interested parties together, further exemplified its commitment to the niche. What was the result of all this focus on a single niche? Early on, the results were underwhelming. In the first year of the program, Lawson's healthcare revenues doubled, but they still were less than 10% of total revenues. Review showed that the sales force was too thinly spread, and so the company reorganized to support a dedicated healthcare unit. In the next year, revenues increased to 15%, and the following to more than 20%. By mid-1998's close of fiscal year, healthcare was more than 30% of revenues, and the company had grown in 5 years from $40 million to $200 million. Most importantly, despite a fast follower attack by PeopleSoft, Lawson has emerged as the acknowledged market leader in healthcare. The game is not over, of course. SAP and Oracle have declared healthcare to be strategic, and PeopleSoft has not folded its tent. But Lawson successfully achieved a position of strength in a game where, from the outset, it was surrounded by larger, better-known, and better-financed competitors. Moreover, it is expanding outward from its initial beachhead, both into other healthcare organizations and taking into other service-related businesses seeking to use scale and process management to meet cost pressures, notably retail franchises and fast food. Whole product elements built for healthcare turn up to have surprising applicability in these new areas, and Lawson's future is targeted on a niche-by-niche market growth plan. Savvy and the real-time inventory tracking market. Now let's turn to the other scenario for crossing the chasm, the one where, good news, there is no enemy fortifying the shore against invasion because, bad news, nobody thinks there is anything there to defend. Here, the vendor must create a market out of whole cloth. Here, the pragmatist buyers, who are the key to the mainstream market, do not reject the new product so much as simply watch it for signs of development. They don't say no. In other words, they just don't say yes. Talk about extended sales cycles. In this situation, entrepreneurs are fighting a race against time. Like the intrepid explorers and colonists of the 16th and 17th centuries, they have landed in terra incognita and have a fixed amount of supplies, working capital, to see them through to self-sufficiency. The question is not whether someday someone will make a successful colony. The question is whether it will be them or whether they will die in the attempt. Let's look at a specific example. In 1992, a small startup in Mountain View won a major contract from the Pentagon for an inventory tracking system. The system was based on radio frequency tags attached to inventory containers, interacting with a radio frequency interrogation device that could pull the tags for their location and associated contents. It turned out that in Desert Storm, although the military was able to get record amounts of inventory to the battle zone in record time, it then could not easily find any specific inventory item once it was on site. This meant lots of opening up of containers to find out what was inside. Fun at Christmas, perhaps, but not under combat conditions. Savvy's devices allowed military logistics managers to conduct these same searches automatically, and during the next deployment in the Bosnian theater, they came through with flying colors. Good show and all that. Now what? To cross the chasm based on a military product commits one to a procurement system that does not lend itself to superior financial returns, to a marketing system that is completely divorced from commercial markets, and to a whole lot of very long, not very stimulating meetings. It is virtually impossible to keep the attention and commitment of a bright R&D team in Silicon Valley with such a prospect. And so the management of Savvy began to cast about for a commercial beachhead for crossing the chasm. Fortunately, it was ready to hand, for the commercial marketplace has the equivalent of such battle zones in every shipping yard in the world. It's the same challenge. You know the inventory is here somewhere, but where is it exactly? If it is perishable inventory, you would like to find it before you smell it. If it is non-perishable, you would like to find it and get it to the right place in the right manufacturing line before the line has to stop for lack of inventory. As the world moves to just-in-time inventory management, this latter need goes from being nice to have to being mission critical. Savvy did an early project with the Toyota Corporation, which taught it hugely valuable lessons in just-in-time management disciplines, and it decided to make the extension of that project the basis for its beachhead attack. In this market, the target customer is the yard manager, and the compelling reason to buy is to sustain a just-in-time inventory flow that is mission-critical to to the enterprise's approach to operations. Recalling that the whole product is the minimum set of products and services needed to fulfill the compelling reason to buy for the target customer, Savvy built the following whole product plan. Savvy Products. Gatemaster. A tractor trailer detection and identification system that detects, collects, monitors, and reports on tag information obtained from tags attached to fleet tractors and/or trailers entering a dedicated yard area. Yardmaster. A wireless communication system linking hostlers, the people who work in the yard, with dispatch functions, thereby automating trailer movement assignments and improving workforce utilization. Dockmaster. A real-time system that makes trailers arriving at dock doors immediately visible to the software applications governing shipping and receiving operations. Passive RFID tags for each truck or tractor trailer to carry identification and contents information. RFDC handheld terminals for both vehicles and hostlers to interrogate tags and upload information into other systems. Asset Manager. A middleware software architecture to take uploaded information from the yard and dock systems and integrate it with existing back-office systems. Savvy Services. Site surveys and system integration. Due to the complexity of each installation, some level of system integration is always required. However, over time, Savvy will seek to convert as much of this function into toolkits to allow most typical integration requirements to be handled on-site by third parties. Alarms and custom user interface software. Currently, as part of each installation, there is significant customization of the system to handle specific alarms and other user interface-related development. Initially, this is provided as a professional service offer. Again, however, over time and as feasible, the company will seek to kit up these capabilities to offer more options deliverable at lower cost. Non-savvy products and services. In any whole product, there are typically elements that the sponsoring company either cannot or should not provide. This is where partners and allies come in. In the case of Savvy, this includes the following. Wintel PC-based server to keep costs down and conform to market standards. Inventory management systems, which could come from a wide variety of vendors focused on shipping and receiving, manufacturing scheduling, supply chain planning, or the like. Business process re-engineering consulting to help management teams redesign their processes, business relationships, communications procedures, and metrics to ensure they can meet the challenges of just-in-time operations. Training, especially in the new processes and behaviors. At the outset of the market, Savvy will train on its own systems itself. But over time, it will seek to delegate that task to third-party partners. Sales and service. Once the market is well underway, to be turned over to value-added resellers. School is still out on the final outcomes of the Savvy effort. In the midst of this effort, the company, a wholly owned subsidiary of Raytheon, was in play. But the offer itself has been taken up by enough additional customers to ensure the company's ongoing place in the market. And that is the primary goal for crossing the chasm. In the case of both Lawson and Savvy, a commitment to the whole product led to an extended shopping list of products and services. Not all of these fell inside the core competence of the companies. Thus, whole product marketing sent them in quest of partners and allies. Partners and allies. Marketing partnerships and strategic alliances are very trendy items in high-tech marketing these days. One expects to see ads in the Wall Street Journal any day now, reading, "Large, well-heeled company with established distribution channels and aging product line seeks small, entrepreneurial, cash-starved technology leader with hot new product. Photos available upon request. Right box number." As a rule, however, these types of alliances do better in the boardroom than on the street. To start with, the company cultures are normally too antithetical to cooperate with each other. Decision cycles are wildly out of sync with each other, leading to enormous frustration among the entrepreneurs and patronizing responses from the established management. To make matters worse, each side has probably misrepresented itself one way or another during negotiations, such that there is plenty of ammunition for each group to fire at the other once tempers get hot. This is particularly likely to be the case when the entrepreneurs have been using acquisition as essentially a financial exit strategy. So for the most part, despite the impeccable logic of these mergers, they are very tough to bring off. Of course, some strategic alliances have been extremely successful. Consider the relationship that developed among SAP, Hewlett-Packard, and Anderson Consulting to displace IBM as the premier enterprise vendor by bringing client-server ERP, Enterprise Resource Planning systems, to market. Or consider the alliance between Intel and Microsoft, what some have called the Wintel duopoly, which to this day orchestrates the PC industry. Both these alliances have been hugely powerful and moved mountains of market cap. Powerful as these relationships are, however, the complexities of developing and maintaining such strategic alliances are enough to daunt all but the most megalomaniacal. They are certainly not the province of mere product managers seeking to ensure that their customers achieve their compelling reasons to buy. What does work for product managers, on the other hand, are tactical alliances. Tactical alliances have one and only one purpose: to accelerate the formation of whole product infrastructure within a specific target market segment. The basic commitment is to co-develop a whole product and market it jointly. This benefits the product manager by ensuring customer satisfaction. It benefits the partner by providing expanded distribution into a hitherto untapped source of sales opportunities. In this context, one need look no further than the internet to see such emerging alliances at work. First, it began with one between Netscape and Yahoo, where the former sent traffic to the latter, so the latter could help people find valuable or enjoyable sites, and thus create more demand for the former's product. And as Yahoo became a portal site, a stepping-off place for entering the internet, it became an alliance partner with commerce sites like Amazon.com and E-Trade, deflecting traffic to their sites. Then, as companies like E-Trade sought to compete against established brands like Charles Schwab, they offered customers committing to their site free email service from vendors like Critical Path. And as other sites sought to attract and hold customers, they bought advertising services from companies like US Interactive or Link Exchange, and marketing services from companies like Post and CKM. All of this, of course, created more business for the tools companies like Microsoft and Symantec, catalog companies like Aspect and Requisite, server companies like Compaq and Sun, service companies like Viant and Cyent, and a legion of others, all intertwining to bring internet commerce into existence. The internet is the furthest thing in the world from a vertically integrated market. It simply would not work without the web of alliances. These types of alliances can often be readily initiated and managed at the product marketing manager level. Typically, The initial opportunity is first brought to the company's attention either by the salespeople or by customer support staff, one of whom has bumped into the potential ally at a particular customer's site. But they can also be anticipated through the exercise of thinking through the whole product solution to the customer's buying objective. The main point, again, is that these are tactical alliances growing out of whole product needs, not strategic alliances growing out of, well, whatever strategic alliances grow out of. My personal feeling is that the number one cause of strategic alliances is too many staff people with not enough to do. To see how this might work out in a single case, consider the case of Farsight Corporation, a software startup focused on the pharmaceuticals industry. It set itself the task of creating a whole new category, computer-assisted trial design. The target customer is the executive in charge of drug trials. The compelling reason to buy is that as many as half of current drug clinical trials, which are hugely expensive and take painfully long to complete, deliver inconclusive results. Better trial design is the answer to this problem. But to date, that has been more the province either of advanced statisticians, special science, or experienced clinicians, black art, and not a discipline accessible to mere mortals. Farsight has brought to market software to structure trial design in systematic, repeatable ways, and to draw on the learnings of prior trials to build models of how future trials might turn out. The market is still in its early phase, meaning that customers want to buy projects rather than products, and Farsight has won market leadership through services-led offerings. This has led it to acquire the product lines of its primary competitors, so that now, blending the three lines together, the company has a rich product offering. But that is not enough. To model a trial, one needs to have model data. That is, one has to input something to stimulate outcomes based on past experience. Some of the models are reusable from trial to trial. Patient population models, which create benchmarks for how a control group might be expected to respond, for example, or design and analysis models for controlling for interactions among multiple variables. Other models will be specific to either a class of drug or a family of diseases. These latter often must be generated not from numbers or formally collected data, but rather from capturing the opinion and experience of experts. What makes all this so challenging is that pharmaceutical companies are intensely competitive with one another and do not want to share any knowledge which they think might be part of their competitive advantage. A lot of the models, in truth, should be, and no doubt eventually will be, in the public domain. That would make them accessible to companies like Farsight, who would add value to them through cataloging, cross-referencing, and cross-verification. But none of this will help the Farsight whole product manager in the short term, nor, for that matter, the company's customers. So how can one proceed? Since the problem is just surfacing at the time of this writing, what follows is speculative, but represents the range of thinking the company is exploring. One way forward is to explicitly partner with customers. Farsight might well barter its own valued services in exchange for rights to productize and distribute certain portions of the data model. The customer would certainly want to protect the bits that would reveal its investigations, but with such incentives, it might well share generic data that could be reused for common metrics. There really is no reason to reinvent the wheel on a population model, for example, since there is little competitive advantage in closely guarding one's own model. And there would be great industry benefit in initiating and continuing to contribute to a robust multi-trial database. Partnering with customers will thus be a key component. The primary challenge, not being technical, but rather cultural. Another potential source of partnership are the public health agencies, who by contrast are highly motivated to pool and share learnings. In addition, however, they might be persuaded to take a more active role. Certain diseases like malaria, for example, are not attracting pharmaceutical investment simply for economic reasons. Death, however, is not an economist, which creates major problems for public health. If the public agencies were able to build data models into a common pool, this could reduce the investment to undertake certain types of drug research and attract more activity into the area without having to fund it directly. A third source of model contributors could be the contract research organizations, the entities that actually conduct the scores of clinical trials needed to garner FDA approval. Productivity is their number one issue, and in return for productivity-enhancing software, they might well be persuaded to support building public data models, particularly if those same models could be reused in subsequent trials, thereby further increasing productivity. A fourth approach, one taken by numerous companies in biotech, is to recruit an advisory board of scientists, typically from the university research community. These are the folks who actually run the clinical trials. Compensation is usually in the form of stock options, which provides financial leverage to the scientists, in return for which they can contribute both work products and relationships. The latter can be extremely valuable in nudging a potential customer to make a contribution to a shared knowledge base. A fifth approach is to enlist the managed care organizations who can give data both from clinical trials and real-life medical practice. They would value the resulting models as a framework for their own practice guidelines, and in so doing, would create another market opportunity where Farsight could add value going forward. Which of these partnerships are most likely to succeed? While it's too soon to call, there is an encouraging underlying dynamic that Farsight's whole product manager will be able to exploit. All these constituencies get together at conferences and trade shows all the time. This allows the company to explore multiple avenues in parallel, cost-effectively. It also allows it to evangelize its ideas in forums where proactive constituencies from the public sector could help persuade colleagues in the private sector to buy in. All in all, this amounts to creating a market. For markets represent more than just a buyer and a seller. They are an ecology of interrelated interests interoperating to create what business schools call value chains. For any company crossing the chasm, fostering the initial partnerships to create the whole product is the equivalent of seeding the value chain, getting it started. Once value starts being generated, the market system becomes self-reinforcing, and the whole product manager's job then is simply to let go and get out of the way. To sum up, whole product definition, followed by a strong program of tactical alliances to speed the development of the whole product infrastructure, is the essence of assembling an invasion force for crossing the chasm. The force itself is a function of actually delivering on the customer's compelling reason to buy in its entirety. That force is still rare in the high-tech marketplace. So rare that, despite the overall high-risk nature of the chasm period, any company that executes a whole product strategy competently has a high probability of mainstream market success. Recap. Tips on whole product management. Again, in keeping with our intent to recap key ideas at the close of each chapter through a tactical checklist, Here are 8 tips on whole product management. 1. Use the donut diagram to define and then to communicate the whole product. Shade in all the areas for which you intend your company to take primary responsibility. The remaining areas must be filled by partners or allies. 2. Review the whole product to ensure it has been reduced to its mineral set. This is the KISS philosophy. Keep it simple, stupid. It is hard enough to manage a whole product without burdening it with unnecessary bells and whistles. 3. Review the whole product from each participant's point of view. Make sure each vendor wins and that no vendor gets an unfair share of the pie. Inequities here, particularly when they favor you, will instantly defeat the whole product effort. Companies are naturally suspicious of each other anyway, and given any encouragement, will interpret your entire scheme as a ripoff. 4. Develop the whole product relationships slowly, working from existing instances of cooperation toward a more formalized program. Do not try to institutionalize cooperation in advance of credible examples that everyone can benefit from it, not the least of whom should be the customers. 5. With large partners, try to work from the bottom up. With small ones, from the top down. The goal in either case is to work as close as possible to where decisions that affect the customer actually get made. 6. Once formalized relationships are in place, use them as openings for communication only. Do not count on them to drive cooperation. Partnerships ultimately work only when specific individuals from the different companies involved choose to trust each other. 7. If you are working with very large partners, focus your energy on establishing relationships at the district office level, and watch out for wasting time and effort with large corporate staffs. Conversely, if you are working with small partners, be sensitive to their limited resources and do everything you can to leverage your company to work to their advantage. 8. Finally, do not be surprised to discover that the most difficult partner to manage is your own company. If the partnership really is equitable, you can count on someone inside your company insisting on taking a bigger share of the benefit pie. In fighting back, look to your customers to be your truest and most powerful allies. 6. Define the battle. On the eve of our invasion, let us regroup. We have already established the point of attack, a target market segment plagued by a problem that gives them a truly compelling reason to buy. We have already mapped out the whole product needed to eliminate this problem and have recruited the necessary partners and allies to deliver it. The major obstacle in our way now is competition. To succeed in securing our beachhead, we need to understand who or what the competition is, what their current relationship to our target customer consists of, and how we can best position ourselves to force them out of our target market segment. This is what we mean by defining the battle. The fundamental rule of engagement is that any force can defeat any other force if it can define the battle. If we get to set the turf, if we get to set the competitive criteria for winning, why would we ever lose? The answer, depressingly enough, is because we don't do it right. Sometimes it is because we misunderstand either our own strengths and weaknesses or those of our competitors. More often, however, it is because we misinterpret what our target customers really want, or we are afraid to step up to the responsibility of making sure they get it. How far must one go to serve one's customers? Well, in the case of